This is On Target St. John's, a look at politics, crime, education. What's happening here with the people who know? The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station. Now, your On Target St. John's host, Linda Swain.
And good afternoon, everyone. Linda Swain on Target St. John's. My in-studio guests this afternoon are two people who are going to tell us a very interesting story. And we've heard this before here in Newfoundland and Labrador. It's got a long history, and it's continuing to have impacts in Newfoundland and Labrador. And there's some new information that's come out this week, and we wanted to talk a little bit more about that. My in-studio guest, Dr. Kathleen Hodgkinson. She's a clinical epidemiologist who specializes in ARVC, and she's going to explain in a minute what that is. She's also a geneticist and a pediatric cardiologist, Dr. Christina Templeton. Hello.
Hello.
Hi. So this is a fascinating story, and a lot of people in Newfoundland and Labrador are already familiar with this whole idea of the Newfoundland curse. This was families who knew there was something wrong, didn't know exactly what it was. You found the key to that in their genes. It's a situation where people suddenly fall down dead, basically, from a heart attack. Tell us what ARVC is.
Well, the name, of course, ARVC, is a lot easier to say than arrhythmogenic right ventricular cardiomyopathy, which is its longer name. But basically, it's one of those cardiac conditions that is inherited that can cause the heart to have structural changes, but primarily it causes the heart to have electrical faults. So it's a bit like causing the heart to have a short circuit. So the heart normally has an electrical impulse that keeps the heart beating regularly and normally. If that is interrupted in some way, then the heart can go into what's a very abnormal rhythm. And at that point, when it's a very abnormal rhythm, the only way to bring anybody back is with an electric shock. And we see that with, you know, AEDs around Newfoundland. You know, the Heart and Stroke have managed to work with schools and get AEDs in all schools, which is fantastic. So the ability to bring somebody back from an attack like that, we now have far greater ability to do that in this province. But that is actually what's needed. So previously, families would have family Bibles. They'd have stories about their uncle running across the beach to get a rabbit and dropping down dead at 32. Dropping down dead, shoveling the snow. Dropping dead, sitting on a sofa, sitting on the back step. Horrible stories that the families, of course, know, remember, and really perceived it in many ways as a curse that was affecting their family and coming across the generations.
And no real symptoms prior to these sudden events?
It's hard to tell, of course, when you can't go back and ask the people, but certainly nothing that brought them to the doctor on many occasions. So whether they did have anything that they recognised, we don't know. But possibly not. Certainly, it may be the first symptom is the last symptom. And that's what's so difficult and was so difficult for the families, because quite often people would come in and have cardiac testing. The cardiac testing is not that clever at picking people up. So people could have cardiac tests that are normal and still have a tragic event weeks later. So the cardiac testing was not always that good.
And this was striking people down in the prime of life.
Well, our earliest was 19, and certainly the early work showed that if you were not treated, then 50% of all men would not reach 40 and 80% would not reach 50. Women did better. It was better to be female in this population. 20% of women would be dead by 50 and 5% by 40. So although too many, not as bad as the men. So this is what we call a sex influence disease, where men and women inherit the gene the same way. They pass the gene on the same way, which is a 50-50. But the disease itself is worse in one sex than the other. And for this, it's worse in men than women.
Now, you've been working. We're going to get Dr. Christina Templeton into this conversation now shortly. But you've been at this for a very long time. You discovered the gene back in 2008. It made world headlines.
Well, it did, and it wasn't. You know, I'm not the laboratory geneticist. I am the person who deals with the families. The person who, you know, did all the hard work to do the gene find, of course, was Dr. Terry Young, and at the time her PhD student Nancy Myrna, who were working in the lab with alongside, you know, Dr. Connors and myself and Dr. Templeton and everybody else who works with the families. And, you know, as a team, we found the gene in 2008, and it was an amazing moment, I have to say. Yes, it was. I will never have a moment like that ever again.
So what were the difficulties in finding the gene?
Well, the difficulties were related to the fact that, you know, certainly in order to find a gene, you have to have affected people with DNA. And if your affected people are deceased, you haven't got DNA from them. And if your clinical tests don't tell you who has the disease because they're not good enough, we really had to collect a lot of DNAs from a lot of family members over many years to have enough that we knew were affected. And often they were women who had a father who died suddenly young and a son who died suddenly young. So that woman had to be the gene carrier. So at that point, they were very important for the gene discovery because they were the absolutely had to have the gene. So they were paramount. So it was just, you know, people think finding genes is easy. I mean, we see CSI, we see, you know, you just have to get a bit of spit and you'll know the name and the breed of the dog and how old it is. I mean, it's not actually like that. Genetics is still very, it's just an incredibly, an incredible amount of information that is very complicated. It's exciting, it's got immense power, but it's not that straightforward.
So there's a lot of process of elimination and it sounds like intuition that's used in helping to narrow some of this down in a scientific way.
Well, you know, medicine is sort of an art as well. And, you know, this has really been a team effort, you know. So certainly from the molecular geneticist's perspective, so the people in the laboratory, the people like myself who are geneticists and genetic counselors who deal with families, people like Dr. Templeton who deals with the children. And, of course, the children have always been an issue to some degree because this was one of those diseases where do you test a child for a genetic condition or not? We have genetic conditions, for example, that affect people in their midlife. Do you test a child for that disease? And this was a condition that was a bit sort of odd, really, because the men got affected earlier than women. So did you test the boys before the girls? What age did you test them at? So it became, you know, certainly from the pediatric cardiology perspective, and I don't know if, you know, Dr. Templeton wants to leap in there, but, you know, it was complicated, I think.
Well, indeed. Do you set a time frame for when a person should be tested?
We do, and we've actually just changed it because of ongoing research and, you know, and new information. So the difficulty with gene testing, as Kathy says, is in some ways just as much about the ethics of the testing as it is the science, right? So if, for example, you think that a child has cystic fibrosis, gene testing, as early as that thought crosses everyone's mind, is the appropriate thing to do because cystic fibrosis is very treatable. It's not at this point curable, but it is very treatable, and the earlier you institute the treatment, the better life the child is going to have. So there's absolutely no question of, you know, hanging around waiting for them to be old enough to understand what they're being tested for. And on the other hand, if you have something that definitely won't cause symptoms until 50 or 60 years of age, it would be very unethical to test a small child for something that you can't do anything about, and then you're at some point going to have to say, oh, by the way, like, we tested you for this when you were 2 years old and had no idea what we were doing to you. So those are the extremes, and ARVC doesn't fit either of those extremes. So that does make it challenging. On top of everything else, we also have a population in Newfoundland, generally, all of us, where we have an astronomically high risk of lifestyle-induced heart disease. You know, we generally all eat too much fat and too much salt, and we don't get enough exercise, and we smoke too much, and, you know, just
drink
collectively
too much.
Yeah, we're not a peak healthy population collectively as a group, regardless of our gene status. So it is very tricky, because you don't want kids held back if they shouldn't be. You don't want them discouraged from exercising if that's not the best thing for them long term. And you are also trying to keep them safe from this disease that runs in their family. So it has been complicated. And as I say, based on recent research, we've actually changed what we're doing.
Well, indeed. And we'll talk a little bit about that more now right after the break.
Now back to Linda Swain on Target St. John's on VOCM.
And we're back. Dr. Kathleen Hodgkinson, a geneticist who is part of a team that helped to discover the gene responsible for ARVC. And Dr. Christina Templeton, a pediatric cardiologist, also part of that same team. My in-studio guests this afternoon, and we're talking about the so-called Newfoundland curse in ARVC. And I'll let you guys say the name of it.
Arrhythmogenic right ventricular cardiomyopathy.
There you go. For families affected, they know all too well about this. Just before the break, we were talking a little bit about the ethics of testing on children, because some people would argue that you need to know these things ahead of time. But as you just pointed out, Dr. Templeton, that there are some problems with that. But you've discovered this week that it's important now to maybe change those parameters a little bit. Explain that for us.
Yeah, so we did just change our recommendations recently. Based on data that shows that extreme exercise in people who carry this gene increases their risk of clinically having the disease, so that it will be more severe and the complications will start earlier. It's not exactly known why that is. The theory is that because the higher blood flow going through the right ventricle, which is the RV part of the ARVC, if those muscle fibers are being stretched by a high volume of blood, that may very well be the precipitating thing that causes the rhythm abnormalities to start. So that part hasn't been proven. That's an educated guess based on the physiology. But the statistics of the fact that extreme exercise is a risk factor have caused us to change what we do. So previously we were recommending testing prior to the age that anyone would be at risk. So as Kathy said, the youngest death within this extended family group was at 19 years of age. So we were recommending gene testing at sort of 16, 17 to make sure that they were safe. We know that children are not at risk of dropping dead of this specific gene type of ARVC. That's not true of every ARVC, and it's certainly not true of every genetic heart disease. There are other conditions where children can die young. But this particular one, it's not that the children themselves are at risk of death. But what we are now trying to do is we are now recommending testing preschoolers so that we catch them ideally up like at 5 years old at the latest, because what we're trying to avoid is kids who go through their entire childhood as competitive athletes, and then we're forced to take that away for their own safety. So it allows, the earlier testing allows for us to try as much as possible to allow families to steer their kids in the right direction. And it does unfortunately mean saying no to them, you know, if they want to be competitive athletes. But we believe it's better, and families tend to agree with us, that it is better to say no to them when they're 6, 7, 8. Tell them, yes, you can play rec league, but no, you can't try out, you know, for the provincial competitive team, because this is a risk for you later on. Because the worst case scenario from a pediatric perspective with this specific disease is a 16-year-old who has been a competitive hockey player their entire childhood and adolescence, who believes themselves to be Olympic material, and then if they test positive for this gene, then, and we have to say, you can't do this, it's dangerous, not only do they lose the sport with which they have defined themselves for the last 10 years, they lose their entire social structure. All of their friends are hockey players. Their parents are coaches and volunteers. And they literally lose everything that is important to them. And it's terrible. And there are situations in which that can't be avoided. You know, there are other heart conditions out there for which we can't do gene screening early. And so it still happens. But within this particular population, we can try to avoid that situation. Because it happens that teenagers can be suicidal. They can be so upset and so disappointed by a positive gene test and the loss of everything that's important to them.
Yeah, that's their entire goal in life has been wrenched from under them. And not only that, but the knowledge that they have this illness, but, you know, every, like you say, their entire life is structured around that. Mm-hmm. So that's what you're recommending now. So what happens now when somebody is diagnosed with ARVC? What is the standard procedure now?
The data that we have clearly shows that we have to implant an implantable cardioverter defibrillator, what we call prophylactically, so particularly in men. So that means the only thing that you've got wrong with you is the fact that you've got the mutation. So all your heart tests can be normal, you can be looking fantastic, but that's irrelevant. We need to put an ICD in. And for men and boys, that's usually, I would suggest, late teens, early 20s. So when they've gone through their growth spurt, we have put them in earlier on occasion. If clinical tests suggest that they need them earlier, they will be put in earlier. But that's the usual. And when we assessed that data, which was published in 2016, what we've been able to show is that for men who get a defib prophylactically before they show any clinical signs, we've added 31 years of life to their lifespan. So comparing to their ancestors and their family members who couldn't avail of the ICD, and this is where having genealogical data is so powerful, because we have access to people who had the same thing but couldn't get the treatment, then we've added 3 decades of life onto them. We've added 2 decades of life onto men who came and they did have something wrong with them, but they got the ICD then. So, and we've added 2 years of life onto women who, that doesn't sound very much, but it's statistically significant because women always lived longer anyway. So for all groups, their lifespan has been expanded and extended by the use of ICDs.
You mentioned that earlier, that men are disproportionately negatively impacted by this particular gene, even though women evenly carry it.
Yes.
Why is that?
Do you know, I don't think we actually know. I mean, you know, in fact, this is where we've got a new colleague coming on, who Dr. Jessica Esseltine, who is a new member of the team, who is a basic medical scientist and who is going to be looking at growing patient cells. So taking skin cells and culturing them and turning them into heart cells so that they beat down the microscope and they're beating on their own, and seeing what's going on in the cell with the mutation, and then using CRISPR, which people have heard of, the gene editing system, to actually edit in or out the TMEM43 gene mutation, all very exciting, you know, to see whether we can actually find out why are men and women different in this respect. One is tempted to say hormones, because of course, you know, women do tend to, if they're going to get more of the disease, do so after menopause. But we have no evidence really for that. It's just an educated guess. Women are somehow protected, as they often are, by the hormones that they have that men don't, in the same, you know, we all have the same hormones, we just have them in different quantities. But
it's fascinating as you're talking. It's almost like, you know, science fiction, really. You know, it's so hard to imagine that we're in this place when only a generation ago people were left to their fate, so to speak.
And I think, if I can say, we're grateful to all the people who funded us. Genome Atlantic, of course, who we're really grateful for the funds they've provided us. Many funders, St. Jude Medical, CIHR, federal funding for the TPMI, Translational Personalised Medicine Initiative. We've been very lucky. And of course, funding is absolutely required to continue research. But I think the nicest thing about this team is that we have the overlap between the clinical and the research. So we overlap totally. So what we find out in research, if it's immediately passable back, it gets passed back because we have those connections and that team that's created. And we think that's the way it should work. We're very proud of that, that we've been able to, create that method of healthcare. Because I think it's to patients' benefit.
Dr. Kathleen Hodgkinson, geneticist, and Dr. Christina Templeton, pediatric cardiologist, my in-studio guests this afternoon, talking about the so-called Newfoundland curse. We'll probe that a little bit further right after this.
Now back to Linda Swain on Target St. John's on VOCM.
And we're back. Dr. Kathleen Hodgkinson and Dr. Christina Templeton of Memorial University are my in-studio guests, and they're part of a team that helped to identify this gene related to this so-called Newfoundland curse. People were dropping down dead with little or no forewarning at very young ages, primarily young men, but it happened among some women as well. And Dr. Hodgkinson, there was a lot of legwork involved in tracking this down and a lot of old-fashioned genealogy that had to be done. And I understand you did a lot of flipping through family Bibles and that sort of thing to try and get a handle on this.
Well, actually, I have to say, privileged to meet an incredible number of Newfoundlanders who are actually expert genealogists and who know an awful lot about their families. And Newfoundlanders tend to do that, don't they? They know their families, they know where they're from, they know the communities they live in. And that has been just amazing, because I'm obviously not from Newfoundland. So for me, it was just a complete education to sort of really understand how Newfoundland really works. So yes, there was a lot of genealogy building up. So we have, for example, we have a family tree that is 12 generations in sort of depth, and probably about 1,300, 1,400 people in that extended pedigree over those generations. And we call that one family, which of course it is, because they're related to a founder pair. And we have 26 other families, all of which are big, none of them quite that big. But they all actually relate to one another because they all share the same DNA background. So this mutation sits on a DNA, a piece of DNA that tends to get inherited together. So it's like thinking of the gene itself is number 10, I don't know, Circular Road. Apologies to anybody who lives at number 10 Circular Road, if there is a number 10 Circular Road. But anyway.
There is. They're my neighbours. It's okay.
Okay. Thank you.
There you go.
So what's your number? I can use that one.
36.
36. Okay. But, if you know it's Circular Road, that house sits on Circular Road, not on Kingsbridge Road, not on, Prince Philip Parkway. So when we look at sort of families elsewhere in the world, we look to see, do they have the Circular Road piece of DNA at the back, or is it a completely different street? And we can show that the families that occur in Northern Germany and Denmark and Norway all have Circular Road as that back street. So, and they all have number 36 as their gene. So we can look back, and our colleagues in Europe have done this, and we can show that probably with the data we have today, this particular mutation, this particular gene change, and a mutation is just a change in a gene's message. That's all. A gene is just a message. So it's a single letter change in this message that probably occurred somewhere between 300 and 600 AD in Northern Europe. And somehow that gene mutation has migrated to Newfoundland. And how that's happened, we don't know. We haven't found it in England or Ireland.
Is that right? How interesting.
Now, it doesn't mean it's not been found in the last week and I happen not to know about that. But, so far when I last was looking, we hadn't found it. So it may be that this came across from Northern Europe directly to Newfoundland. We don't know the answer to that. So that's very interesting. But we do know that all our families here and all those families there have a common ancestor. they are all related to a person between 300 and 600 AD somewhere in Northern Europe.
I'm dying for it to be a Viking. Absolutely no historical evidence that it could in any way be a Viking, but I just want it to be a Viking because that would be such a cool story.
Wouldn't it though? Because we do have a bit of a history with the Vikings here, as we know, now know. So this would have been one individual or perhaps a couple of siblings?
Well, the mutation event had to have happened in an individual who would then have potentially had children and siblings would then. So it's a 50-50 risk. So you can see if it happened in an individual, because mutations occur out of the blue just because we copy our DNA from generation to generation. So when we, if we're females, we make eggs. If we're males, we make sperm. And in doing that, we copy our DNA. And that's a lot of DNA to copy. And there's lots of mistakes that are made. And the body's very good at working out those mistakes and mending them. But sometimes they don't always mend all of them. So sometimes a mistake can occur which is devastating and doesn't go anywhere. Or a mistake can occur like this one, which actually is compatible with a normal lifespan. And that then, from that one person, if they had 10 children on average, five would have it. Those five children, if they each had 10 children on average, each of them would have five. You can see how it becomes a pyramid going down very, very quickly, and that gene passing on. And that's indeed how it probably happened. So it would have started in one person as an event that occurred in some copying of DNA and a mistake that occurred.
So all of these families are connected. Do you know what family started it all?
No, we just, I mean, clearly it was some person back way 300, 600 AD. We can certainly trace our families here to a couple from, I think, 1799. I haven't been able to go back any further. The answer to that is we don't know. But, I mean, certainly anybody who has this mutation with this particular circular road background, we do realise it's nothing to do with circular road. I just use that as an analogy. But, yeah, you know, with that particular background, mm-hmm, they all must be related. There are actually families in the world that have this same mutation. So, again, this same change, but the background street is not circular road. So that happened in some other person by chance in history. So the disease is the same. You know, we see the same outcome. It's the same spelling mistake, but it's not the same event.
How interesting. So these, is it to a particular area of Newfoundland primarily? Have you at least managed to narrow that down? Bonavista, Trinity, Conception Bays, St. John's, South Coast?
There are areas where this is more common than others. It's definitely, and I probably won't mention them just because, of course, it's very difficult to maintain confidentiality quite often. But there are specific areas where there's more of it than others. You know, and those families who are there know who they are, of course, and are being seen and followed and treated.
Dr. Christina Templeton is a pediatric cardiologist, and you were talking about the genetic testing for this and letting children know at a certain age. You've changed your parameters and allowed this to be a bit younger because, as you said, the gene does affect children, particularly if they're into heavy-duty sports. I imagine competitive hockey and other types of things like that where you really, the blood is really pumping. What about in cases where a child is tested, they're 2, 3, 4 years old? Should a parent tell the child at that stage, or what are some of the difficulties that can accrue from that?
Yes, well, certainly my professional universal recommendation is yes, absolutely, you should tell your child, or I can tell your child, however you want to do that. It can be very tricky. Obviously, a two-year-old hasn't got the faintest idea what you're talking about. But if you don't tell them while they're young, first of all, they're not stupid. And if they keep coming back every year for heart appointments and we keep saying, okay, good, see you next year, they're not dumb. And, you know, they do figure out there's something going on, particularly if they have siblings who didn't inherit the gene and don't have to do these tests, then it's really obvious to them that there's something going on. the other thing that children are very good at is knowing when they're being lied to about anything. If you've ever tried to keep any important secret, even though it might be the most benign thing in the world, you know, like we're going on this wonderful vacation or something lovely like that, it is not easy to keep secrets from children. They have what a friend of mine refers to as inappropriate content radar. And they they know that you are hiding something, whether it's a good thing or a bad thing. So it is absolutely, completely our universal recommendation that everything be done wide open up front, so that while they, you know, as a preschooler, they have no idea why any of this is going on. But every year as they come, you know, they actually don't need clinical testing very, very young, because we know it's not going to show anything. It's tricky enough to get it to show anything even in adults when you need it to. It doesn't show anything in young kids. But we do start clinically screening them as preteens. So they're having ultrasounds of their heart. They're having EKGs and Holter monitors, which are 24-hour heart rhythm tests. So certainly by that point, in my professional opinion, they absolutely need to know why these things are being done and what the implications are, because the last thing you want is distrust, right? You don't want the kids not trusting their parents. You don't want the kids not trusting their healthcare team. You want a healthy, open relationship where they are comfortable asking the big questions, right? They need to be able to say things like, am I going to die? And you can't say that if you don't trust the person that you're asking.
Indeed. So the defibrillator is traditionally not put in until they've gone through their growth phases?
Yes. Yes. They're not at risk younger than that. We can say that quite confidently, especially if we're doing, you know, the clinical testing. The youngest death was at 19 years of age. So we can be, there's many more illnesses that I look after kids with that I have less information than this, even though ARVC is technically a rare disease worldwide. But because of all of the research that happens here, I actually have more information about it than I do a lot of the more common illnesses that we're treating every day. So we can confidently say that kids don't need defibrillators too young, which is a good thing, because you can grow out of your defibrillator.
Finding this gene marker now, has this helped in other research that you're doing?
Well, I think it's we just carry on trying to find new genes, and of course they occur every day. So we have a clinic that started in 1998, and we've seen about 1,600 families in that clinic. 27 of them are this particular gene, and many of the others, as Dr. Templeton has actually alluded to, are, you know, diseases that can cause sudden death as well, some of which we know the underlying genetics and many of which we don't. So there's an incredible amount of work that still goes on with families to see, you know, whether we can actually detect what is actually occurring to cause, you know, a tragedy. You know, I see many families for which we just don't have the answer. The genetics has not helped us. In fact, the genetics just makes it very complicated. At some point, though, we will know. You know, at some point over time, we will know. This is not quick. You know, we started this in the end of the 90s, and, you know, it was 2008 when we found, you know, when the gene was published. And I mean, we're still working on that same particular mutation now, and there are hundreds of other mutations out there. So the research keeps going. And, you know, I think that we have great Faculty of Medicine colleagues in basic medical sciences who are also, you know, involved in looking at a lot of these mutations. So, yeah, we keep going. We keep hoping to get research dollars, and I'll never retire.
And I was going to talk a little bit about that as well, what makes Newfoundland and Labrador so important when it comes to this kind of research. But we'll get into that right after the break.
Now back to Linda Swain on Target St. John's on VOCM.
And we're back. Deep in conversation that time. Dr. Kathleen Hodgkinson and Dr. Christina Templeton of Memorial University are in their, the studio with me today. They're part of a team that helped to identify this gene that was related to a very devastating heart condition. And Dr. Hodgkinson, we were talking a little bit about the genetics involved in this and some of the long, hard work work the team put into trying to identify this and nail it down. But what makes Newfoundland and Labrador so unique when it comes to this? Because it's not the only disease that's been discovered here. There have been other mutations that have been discovered as well in this province. What makes us so important in those types of research goals?
I actually don't think it's much necessarily to do with the fact that there's more of things here. I think that can be a bit erroneous, but I think it's because it's a small population and you can access more people. So we've got a founder population, so we can actually see this gene running across generations. People know who their families are. People want to help with research. So, I mean, all of those factors mean that we have a very powerful population here. And I think our greatest strength here is because sequencing can occur anywhere now. You know, we can all send our DNA off and get our sequence back, you know, in a week or however long it is for however much money they're charging. But the sequence alone is irrelevant. The thing that matters is what's it looking like? What happens to the person? And that's the area of research that Newfoundland truly has immense power in, which is being able to look at how the disease affects people. So if you have a family of 12 people, six of whom have a mutation that you're interested in and six don't, you have your control population there already because the six who don't are your controls. So things that they have in their family background or their environment, they share them. But the thing that's different is the mutation. So you can actually do incredibly powerful research here that tells everybody else how things work. So for example, our ICD recommendations, which are for prophylactic, as I said earlier, you get the ICD just because you have the mutant gene. International guidelines do not support that for general ARVC, because ARVC can be caused by multiple other genes as well. And the international guidelines say, no, you don't implant a prophylactic ICD. If we followed international guidelines, our patients would have died. So the fact that we have enough people here and the research here to say for this mutation we do this means that families in anywhere else in the world can avail of that information that they would not otherwise be able to get. And the people say, okay, well, we're not going to follow those guidelines, we're following theirs because they have all the information about that mutation. And so people are saved elsewhere because of the research that goes on here. And that's true for any of the diseases that are being researched here and which are present here, you know, the gastric cancers or the gynecological cancers, and families with those know, you know, how devastating they can be obviously as well. And so, but they're phenomenal resources for research. And all I can say is thank you to every Newfoundland family who's ever participated in research, because truly the teams would not be anywhere without you, quite frankly.
Do you get a good participation rate? Do you get people saying yes, sure, let's do this?
Well, I have to say participation rates here are phenomenally high. I think, you know, the diseases, when they have a very devastating effect, mean that people want to have an answer. But people want to... Newfoundlanders are very unselfish. Generally, you know, people, they want to help. It's like, oh, if I can do something to help somebody else, that's great. So, you know, I think it's been a phenomenal sort of experience. And without the families, there would be no team. Quite, you know, it wouldn't matter who was there. Without their participation, we go nowhere.
You talked a little bit about the difficulties in testing and when to know when to test and that sort of thing. Is there any other further difficulties, Dr. Templeton, when it comes to once that information is known and what happens to that information and who has a responsibility to tell others?
Oh, absolutely. Genetic information is tricky all the time, you know. So there's, in this particular situation, if we're just talking about one single gene, at least we have good information about what that means for people and, you know, what the treatment plan should be. And we still, it's not perfect, and I would love to have more specific exercise information. You know, we would love to be able to find something to be able to say to families, this is how much you can do, and, you know, that we don't have anything right now that gives us the ability to say, okay, you know, this 4 hours of the chosen sport is fine, but the hour number five is going to be when it's risky, you know, that we don't have that information yet. So there's still lots of information out there. And there are the challenges of the fact that everyone responds to information differently, has different values, has different understanding, and, you know, but that's just... that's life, isn't it, really? Like, we're all different.
Well, indeed, and I guess some of the, and we talked a little bit about this during the break, is that some of the difficulty may be that, you know, sibling one and two have the gene and sibling three refuses to get tested, even though they might be in some kind of a, you know, they might be an airline pilot or something like that. So is that part of some of the ethical questions that get raised in these kinds of situations?
There is no doubt about that. And our other team member, who I haven't actually mentioned yet, of course, is Dr. Daryl Pullman, who is the professor of bioethics. And, of course, we've worked very closely with a lot of these ethical dilemmas that come up, because genetic information is not just yours, is it? So we work on a system medically where everything is confidential. It's confidential to you and your caregiver. But the problem is, as you've just said, we share our information. Our siblings share 50% of our information, as do our parents, as do our own children. So whose information is it and who owns it? And so there's the first issue, which is if a family member does not want to tell other family members that they're at risk, do the clinicians involved have a duty to somehow breach the confidentiality of the person they're seeing to make sure that the other person can actually avail of testing to save their own life if that's necessary? And you alluded to the concept of maybe somebody who doesn't want testing, who's maybe driving a bus full of children or putting other people at risk. There's nothing in Canadian law that actually speaks to that. There's no precedent, but certainly Dr. Pullman and the rest of the team do feel that there is an issue of duty to warn here in certain circumstances. It's not true of all genetic conditions. It's not true of all cardiac conditions. But for a disease like this, where the first symptom can be the last, if members of the public are being put at risk, then that does provide some sort of onus. But how that works, there is nothing, you know, and we've written quite extensively on the difficulty of this particular issue.
Yeah, if a psychiatrist feels that a patient is at grave risk of harming someone else, you know, if a psychiatrist is assessing a patient and they are expressing a clear, specific threat to a member of their family or a neighbor that they believe is persecuting them or whatever, there actually is a guidelines, you know, for how that physician is supposed to respond in that situation and protect the potential victim. And I'm sure in a lot of those circumstances, the risk that the person is actually going to follow through and harm them is probably not 50%, but the risk of your sibling's death could be as high as 50% with this disease. So that's there probably should be, you know, rules in there to allow us to violate, because we would be violating somebody's confidentiality.
Well,
to
indeed,
do that.
And no doubt there's, you know, real concerns there. Mm. You know, some people have privacy concerns and that sort of thing, but also there's the whole insurance issue, right? And so people might have a real concern when it comes to that sort of thing.
And I think people, and that's why we have great genetic counselors. You know, we have Fiona Curtis, who does all the cardiac genetic stuff. And, of course, that's part of the whole process of talking about it. I think for diseases like ARVC, though, you've got to marry it with the disease is so devastating and the outcome is so not, you can't come back from death, that maybe insurance takes a bit of a lesser stance to some degree, because you know, you can have insurance but you're dead. So it really is very, and of course the insurance issue, lots of the diseases are very different, they're different, they affect people at different times. It really is a case of talking about this, hopefully to a good genetic counsellor or a good insurance person or your good GP or your good friend, to say what are the pros and cons, you know. But things that are clinical, as was pointed out earlier, if it's cystic fibrosis, you test. Nobody is saying we're not going to test because, you know, they might, the child won't be able to get insurance because that saves their life. So it's that balance that you have to achieve. And it's not always straightforward. Mm. And, you know, when you can live a normal life with ARVC, depending if you're a woman who, then the insurance issue becomes a much bigger issue. So,
well, indeed, the science alone is fascinating, but then it has all these real life implications, of course.
It does.
It's a fascinating topic for sure. And we could go on and on because there's so many of these types of things that affect families in this province and elsewhere. Doctors Kathleen Hodgkinson and Christina Templeton of Memorial University, thank you very much for coming in this afternoon. Fascinating conversation.
Well, thank you very much. It was Great fun. Thank you.
Really appreciate your time. Tomorrow, of course, is Shrove Tuesday or Pancake Tuesday. And my in-studio guest to talk a little bit about that will be none other than Dale Jarvis, who knows a thing or two about folklore and is probably listening to the show with great interest as well, because there's a little bit of that tiny bit of overlap there. But so stay tuned for that. We hope to hear from you then.